Labor Day deals are looking good at Lowe's. Save $10 on 1 gallon cans and $50 on 5 gallon pails of select interior paint via rebate. Plus, get two 2.5 quart or 3 quart Mums for just $8. A fresh look and savings? Even better. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Mum sizes vary by location and exclude Alaska and Hawaii. See store at Lowe's.com for more details.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Here we are, Lindsay Clancy. We're getting very close to closing arguments. And Wednesdays, as we always do, we are going to break into the psychological end of this case. Lindsay Clancy, of course, paralyzed from the chest down, has been under round-the-clock suicide watch since January 23. If the jury convicts, the most likely destination is MCI Farmingham, the oldest women's prison in the country, operating since 1877. Psychotherapist Siobhan Scott is with us to help us break all this down. What happens if she goes to prison? What happens if she stays in a mental health facility like Tewksbury? Where does this all go? We're going to talk about Patrick as well today. But let's start here. For 3.5 years, Lindsay Clancy has been a patient. Everyone around her, nurses, doctors, aides, exist to help her. The system has currently said, yeah, she doesn't belong in the county jail. She belongs in a mental health facility. A guilty verdict makes her an inmate, and everyone around her exists to contain her. Like I said, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author with myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. I guess I want to start here. Why is it, Siobhan? I know this is probably a function of how our system currently works, but you have a system that currently has said this woman does not belong in a jail. She belongs in a mental health facility, and she's been there ever since, still is to this day. Why is it that what could happen next is a decision that is very much about mental health? It's very much about where she goes from here, that could remove her from a hospital like setting where she is contained securely to something that is not that. And it's a decision about mental health that will be made by people who are not practicing in the world of mental health, just regular folks out on the road, jurors making the decision about something so critically important that are not educated on it. That to me, it just seems bizarre. It seems strange, but I know this is how our system works. What are your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think looking at all the clinical evidence that we've been hearing all week, she's seriously mentally ill. She belongs in a place that's focused on support for mentally ill people and treatment. Now, prisons do have units or wards or whatever they call it, for people who have disabilities, whether they be severe psychiatric disabilities, health disabilities. They're not typically put in the general population, and I think that would not happen for her just because she's paralyzed. But it's not going to be the same level of care and the intensity of care that she's getting at Tewksbury, where she's at right now. And certainly from all the evidence, everything we've heard this week, she's severely mentally ill. And the treatment that she would get at Tewksbury is certainly ethically the right thing to do for her.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a real ethical conundrum, I mean, to me, like, that this is how it, but it is, I mean, it is how it works, Robin.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you, Tony. And what an insightful question. I'm not validating you for the sake of it. I mean, this is probably, I think, one of the harder, there's so many hard things to this, but this is one of the bigger ones for me as well, because as a jury, their job is not to think in terms of sentencing.
Yeah.
Yet their decision is going to impact the sentencing to this point. And so this is an interesting gap I'm seeing here, because to everyone's point, there's, like Siobhan said, there's not one mental health professional that's testified for either side that says she's well. And she's and which is an interesting observation. She has been in a facility for mental health since she committed a horrendous act. Yeah. And yet, based on 16 people, 16 or 18? I'm sorry.
18.
18, someone else is going to make the decision who's not a clinician on where she spends the rest of her life. Or if she's found not responsible by reason of insanity or whatever, it'll be an undetermined amount, but definitely for the long foreseeable future. So that's a very, very interesting ethical question.
It seems like an odd place for the road to split and for who's making that decision, where it's not a medical professional making a medical decision for someone based on a judicial ruling. But I mean, it is what it is. Let's talk about what that...
One more thing, Tony. So here's a bit of hope I have in this one. Again, I use that word hope in places and maybe sometimes where you shouldn't. I like the judge in this. You know, and so he's going to be one that's in charge of sentencing. So let's, no matter what happens in the outcome, I'd be really fascinated to see what happens next. And also, we know Reddington's made enough enough smoke and fires throughout this thing that there's going to be a large number of appeals on whatever the outcome is, if it's not
Appealable
to them.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. If she were to be found guilty, it's just, this is not a patient or a defendant here that necessarily has the
should be in Gen Pop.
Yeah, that I think has the gusto to survive years and years of appeals or anything like that. I mean, I think she's fragile as hell.
Good point, too.
Let's talk about what it looks like in a facility. Siobhan, you had said that, you know, it's probably not going to be Gen Pop. This is a woman who can't get from her bed to her wheelchair without two people lifting her. Mm-hmm. In a hospital, being that helpless is safe. In a prison, she'd be defenseless in a building full of women who... you know, may despise what she did, may not have the most understanding for what happened. Granted, even if it is, best case scenario here, she's not in Gen Pop, she's in a segmented area. What does that actually look like behind bars? What kind of dangers does she face? What's the reality of what this would be if she goes behind bars?
Yeah, I don't know that, I would doubt that a prison is going to have her with people monitoring her in the same room and being with her for support 24/7, which is what she's had. And how much time is she going to be alone? We know that urge to unalive herself is still very, very strong, which is one reason that they're watching her so closely. And I'm guessing that she's getting some supportive care from those people watching her. And so that would be, I think, absent in prison to that degree. And so her odds of survival would probably go down because there are going to be more opportunities for self-harm.
And not just that, but general population harm. Even if she's segregated to some, I tried as well to do some research on where she might wind up if she's convicted. And the outlook is not good, you know, because she's going to be vulnerable because of being paralyzed and also because of the self-harm issues that she's continually dealing with, especially, I mean, everything's kerosene on that fire for her right now at this point. And then you actually have the act of what she did herself with the filicide, which actually makes her another target as well. Yeah. Because as divided as we are here on the outside about how we feel about her on the mental health side versus the other population side, the same thing is going to exist in there as well, except they have more vitriol towards it potentially.
Well, quite often when it comes to S-Watch or ideations and such, it's not that, you know, in a jail setting in Massachusetts, that individual is going to be put into, you know, very likely a lockdown type setting, a stripped down cell with not the means to do that. I mean, as much as they can reduce that, if you will, the chances of it. But I mean, when you're talking about, I mean, the goal is clearly not to help the person anymore. It's more so to contain the madness, if you will. It seems insanely inhumane. But again, this does happen every day to inmates that are suffering from mental health problems. But it is how we do it. We'll lock them away in a place where they can't necessarily hurt themselves. Does it ever really help anything, removing the objects or means to which someone could hurt themselves with, and putting them into a quiet room where nobody else is around in a prison? Or does that tend to make things even worse for someone who's already on the precipice of psychosis?
Yeah. Isolation is very hard on people psychologically. And we know that they often deteriorate if they're isolated. So where she is now, I'm guessing that she has groups, she has activities, you know, productive activities, things that she can do and be involved in. She would have regular therapy. And so that's probably not going to be available to her. And so for her to survive psychologically in prison is just going to be a lot more challenging.
Yeah, what happens to that, Siobhan? You know, because everyone's right on this one about most likely being in isolation because of the self-harm issue she's dealing with. And so we don't have to even take a look at or focus on the hypothesis of her psychotic break. Just look at what all the clinicians agreed upon, that high SI ideation plus action, bipolar, either one or two, which I know mm-hmm. you're a much bigger expert mm-hmm. on that. I mean, all these mental health issues she's dealing with, what's that? Because I know, look, right now, observing her, looking at her, and even hearing some reports, she sounds stable-ish from what mm-hmm. we've seen. If you mm-hmm. put her in that kind of isolation, we know it's not good psychologically. Mm-hmm. What happens to her brain next? What do you think starts escalating from there?
She certainly could develop more symptoms. And depression has been a significant problem, anxiety a significant problem, and that could certainly increase in a prison system.
What do you say, Siobhan, to people? There's plenty watching right now that are going and saying, she doesn't deserve group activities. She doesn't deserve anything that is beyond the basics. She killed her three children, the babies. What do you say to that? For folks who really have zero empathy, zero sympathy, mm-hmm. zero care whatsoever for where she ends up, whether that be in a prison setting or a tank of sharks.
Yeah, we're seeing, as we've talked about, and I know you've been talking about it, the incredible lack of compassion. And I'd say a lot of it is sadistic, the things people are writing. And this urge to see her as a monster and to see her as miserable as she can possibly be. A lot of people want her eliminated, you know. Mm-hmm. It's troubling. I think there are a lot of troubling things about this case. It's a very painful case to listen to the testimony. But people are just acting out in rage about what they see, what they want to see happen to Lindsay. And that, I think, for me, it's been shocking and rather depressing and sad to see the lack of awareness and this vicious, vituperative desire to see her tormented. And mm-hmm. it's unfortunate.
It's shocking, like you said, to watch people want to treat her and regard her like we're regarding Koberger.
Yes.
And it's like they're clumping those two people together, but they're apples and oranges different about what was going on inside that brain. And I think that's people's quick knee-jerk reaction, and then they double down on it because they don't want to contradict anything they say to or believe from the very beginning and onset. It's because of their lack of understanding. But it's pretty profoundly different.
And they won't listen to me. I know you've heard me say this probably 24 times, but I'll keep saying it in case new people are listening. And I just want to reinforce, a psychopath is not psychotic.
Right. Yeah.
A psychotic person is not a psychopath. And it just seems like, no matter how many times I say it, people that are invested in rage and punishment, they don't want to hear it, you know? I mean, they just don't want to hear the basic facts.
Is it because those folks are too close to actually being one or the other? and well, it's just flying too close to the sun, and it's just like, nope, can't accept that.
That would be a really interesting study. I think sometimes yeah. they're just people who, as we say, don't think in a sophisticated manner. They don't have an open mind. They can be addicted to rage, and they get this amped up you know, people that are watching it for hours and hours and hours and are only in their bubble where everybody's saying the same thing. This just becomes their reality, and it's not reality. And, you know, they don't want to be confused by the facts.
It's an interesting way to watch it, too, because as you're saying, watch it for hours and hours and hours. I'm like, uh-oh, I'm watching this for hours and hours and hours. But here's an interesting take on it. Like, we were talking about this right before the show. In the last couple of days, especially with Dr. Resnick, and we agreed on this as well, for the prosecution, I'm watching for hours and hours and hours, and most times what we're seeing for these other people are like, see, I told you, because they're cherry-picking their own confirmation bias to prove their preconceived notions to fill in those gaps. Yeah. Meanwhile, I'm listening to Dr. Resnick, and I go, ooh, that's an interesting ad I hadn't thought of. You know, so there's a different way in which to interrogate that information and critically think through the things you're listening to. As I said yesterday, the greatest thing I think for people like us that try to critically think these things and also remain humble, the fact that I can be very wrong sometimes and oftentimes sometimes, is when we change our minds. You know, is being open to the fact that, wow, my mind can be changed on this, or at least waver, wobble, explore it more deeply. Because again, Resnick, I thought, and I know we'll get into it, just did a really good job of expanding things a little bit more and encapsulating, like you said, what all the clinicians are saying and can agree upon, even though each of them has their own specialty differences and experiences.
Mm-hmm. You know, an option we don't have here in the United States, and some countries do, is the choice to humanely self-exit the planet. This is something that really hasn't been brought up in this case at all. She's talked about it several times. She doesn't want to be here. The only reason she's still here is because a lot of people that are not her have made sure that she kept herself alive and removed the possibilities of herself exiting. Is this uniquely an American problem that we have I guess being open to this possibility, where other places do this humanely, and it's not always just when someone is severely critically ill, if you will, you know, with cancer or something of that nature. Lindsey Clan, and it's a very, you know, touchy subject for a lot of folks, but at the same point, in a case like this, where this has happened, she went through this hell, she's out of the psychosis now, and she's seen what the hell happened. If that were me, there's no therapy, there's nothing that's going to, like, make me a whole human being. Yeah. There's nothing that I'm going to be, oh, let me get on with my day and find something better to do that's going to be worthwhile. Honest to God, in a case like this, is that something that should really be on the table for more people? Do you want to go through this? This is a circus show. And it's mainly for everybody out here. It's not for you. We're not teaching you a lesson. We're not putting you away so you learn how wrong of what you did was bad. This is someone, if we accept that she was mentally ill, she was in a state of psychosis, and she clearly doesn't want to be here anymore. What are we doing this for other than for ourselves?
It's a tough question. I have probably my own biases. I think if people are terminally ill with cancer, they're suffering, they've gone through treatment, there's not going to be a saving of them, and they're looking at a very long, lingering death. I fully 100% support it. I had a friend with ALS who, when it progressed to the point that she could not swallow and she could not speak, she made the decision, you know, for a medical assistance in dying.
Yeah.
100%, I get that. But when we get into mental health issues, I'm a little more cautious because, as I always say, I like to hold hope.
Sure.
Even in these dark cases, and I have hope that even particularly if she goes to Tewksbury or another psychiatric facility, that maybe over time she could regain a quality of life that made it worth living. You know, maybe she would have something to say to the world that would help people understand this. So that's just my bias.
Sure. No, it's a fair argument. And I agree. But whose choice is that to make, I guess? Is that, it's a hope for those of us on the outside that maybe she could add something to it's such trite words, conversation, you know, that, that people have in our understanding of this from a perspective that only she can deliver, which could be very powerful. But again, you're asking her to continue to live when maybe she doesn't want to. Yeah. I mean, in so many cases, I totally understand where you're coming from, especially on mental health. This is one, though, where it's like, I can totally understand why you want out. and why essentially the rest of her existence on this planet is worse than living with a terminal illness, I would say, almost.
Yeah. I would say, though, at the same time, if she's found not competent to, you know, to be able to be accountable for the action she took, being able to be competent enough mentally to make that choice as well is something I would say is an interesting
medicated in her right mind?
But at the same
time, that's someone who's got their wits about them. That's making an educated choice. Just because someone chooses they want to do that doesn't mean that they're not, you know, in a mental state that, competency.
So I did look it up, though, since we brought it up. You know what I do. No country has a recognized legal pathway that lets someone in cases like this self-execute or assisted euthanasia. The ones that do allow assisted euthanasia under very tight restrictions for, like we're talking about, medical reasons is like Netherlands, Belgium, Canada, Spain, and a few others. But it's under strict rules, very tight guidelines. But people in this type of situation are not eligible for those assists in any of those countries as well. So this does not exist since we brought up the hypothesis, which is an
interesting one. Should.
Well, it's an interesting hypothesis. Or thought experiment, I should say. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that before. It's interesting to think about.
I know. I mean,
it's tragic as well.
It's horrible. It's horribly tragic. And I'm not saying it is like anything light about it, but it's like, well, I don't know. Some cases.
And if you think about it, too, would it really serve the people that want to see her tortured? Because they wouldn't want her to be able to choose it. They'd want her to suffer through it. So I don't know if it would silence the sadistic ones out there anyway. But it would only be to bring her peace. But there's so many aspects of this that I've never felt underqualified to speak on so many things except this case in such a long time on so many different areas. That's why I'm really leaning in hard on the medical professionals on this one because there's like every day I'm learning a different little nuance, a different little difference. And that's why thank God we have Siobhan with us today every Wednesday.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of emotions here. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. If this jury finds Lindsay Clancy not criminally responsible, she does not walk free. Contrary to popular belief, she's not going to be like, where are you going next? Disneyland. That's not what's going to happen. Massachusetts law sends her basically back where she's been, psychiatric facility for observation and long-term commitment. She's already been at Tewksbury State Hospital for more than 3 years. The question isn't whether she'd be released. It's what happens next inside that system. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is with us, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. So under Massachusetts law, the court can order a 40-day observation period after an insanity verdict. And the DA can petition for 6 months, then another 6 months. Andrea Yates was found not guilty by reason of insanity in 2006, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. She's still in a state facility 20 years later. Is commitment a shorter road or a longer one here, Siobhan? And how would this play out? Is it constantly a renewal every 6 months on the part of the state? Or explain to the audience what would happen here.
I'm so glad you asked that question because this was one of my jobs in my forensic history where I was one of the people that went in every 6 months to do evaluations. How is this person doing in the facility? What kind of progress are they making? Are they deteriorating? Are they taking medication? Are they still symptomatic? Are they aggressive? I mean, it was a really comprehensive evaluation. And I worked for the state of California, and we had a team in our county, and it went county by county. So everybody that was in an institution like this who had committed a crime, it was a locked facility, a rather... and from what I hear about Tewksbury, the prisons, or I call them the forensic prisons, right? It was for the mentally ill folks who had committed crimes. Not a terribly pleasant place, not what we think of as a private mental health facility at all. Quite prison-like in many ways, but there was more treatment going on than you would get in a prison. But that was one of the things. When we had people that were released, they went into our program, the conditional release program, where they were very closely monitored. There was a team of therapists. We each had no more than 7 people that we closely monitored. We had daily contact with some, depending on how they were doing. Otherwise, it was, you know, weekly individual therapy, weekly group therapy, sometimes 2 groups a week. They were drug tested. We went out and did surprise home inspections. I mean, it was really closely monitored to make sure that they were safe in the community, because the number one criteria for being out after you've been in a situation like this is safety of the community. Now, some of those people had been in that program for 20 and 30 years where they were living in the community, but we were monitoring them. But the other piece of that job, I was the person, and I wasn't the only one, it was everyone on the team that had a group that we followed that were still in the institution. And we would go in every 6 months, that was the law, and we would do a full evaluation of how they were doing in the institution. And we would go through every record, we would have an interview with them. If they had had recent psych testing, we would go over the results of that. And then we could make a recommendation to the court, this person is doing so well. They're no longer symptomatic. They have insight into their condition. And we would write all that up, document it. It was copious records that we kept. And then it went back to the team. And it was, yeah, this person is looking terrific. They've made so much progress. We believe they could, you know, go into the conditional release program. And they would have a shot at life outside. Now, that could be 10 years later. It could be 20 years later. Or it could be never. And there were many, many people who were never going to be well enough to get out. So it could, in essence, be a life sentence. And very seldom, in fact, I can't think of one that I went in and interviewed and recommended that this person should be looked at closer for possible release. So it's rare. It's rare to get out. And it does happen. Some people make tremendous progress and do have a recommendation to get out, but it's not common.
And so some great points there, Siobhan, and I apologize for my mic falling a second ago, everyone. So as I understand it from you, so you're the psych team inside the prison at the mental health prison, they make their recommendations to the court, but still it's ultimately the judge and the court that decide whether they're released or not. Then based upon, I'm guessing, the totality of what actually that crime was. In other words, if you had the judge, and you, even if you and your team make that recommendation that we think she's fit to reenter society, the judge could still say, yes. Nope, no. Killed 3 kids, never.
Yeah. Never. Yeah. Or we're going to reevaluate every 6 months for the rest of their stay. Right. It's going to be an every 6 month evaluation. Right. And I didn't actually work in the facility. I worked outside of the facility, but I would go into the different state hospitals across the state every 6 months and go over all the staff records, any testing that had been done, their behavior, you know, and they had treatment goals in the facility. How were they doing with their treatment goals? I knew, just to toss out an example, one guy was never going to get out. His treatment plan in the facility, he was so low functioning, was he will stop drinking out of the toilet and stop stabbing the other inmates in the lunch line with pencils. And okay, this guy was never going to get out. You know, this is not a person who's going to improve. And there were a lot of folks like that. So it, you know, people who had committed certain kinds of horrendous sex offenders, they were not going to get out because they were just never going to be considered safe to be in the community.
Let me throw some of the things your way that I know some of the audience is thinking, and you can answer it. What if she fakes her way out? What if she finds a way to fool all the doctors, Siobhan?
I personally have not seen that happen. And yeah. Again, we get into, is this a psychotic person or is this a psychopathic person?
Yeah.
And when we look at people who do that, who in prison go before the parole board and come up with this elaborate story about how they've changed and progressed, that's psychopathic. And yeah. When you're dealing with folks with severe mental illness, it just doesn't really go that way. So I'm very skeptical of that happening.
Does she have a choice? I mean, Andrea Yates is still in a facility. And I know I have read that she doesn't want to leave. I don't know the predicate before that of how that all functions. So I'm asking you, is it up to her? Is it up to Lindsay? I mean, if she is deemed okay to release into society outside of the facility, who ultimately makes that call? And if the facility says, you're good to go, but she's like, I'm happy here.
Yeah.
Does she have a say?
Excellent question. And the only people who would be considered good to go would be people who are eager to go and have a very clear life plan. How am I going to make sure that I stay on my medication? How am I going to make sure that I don't have a relapse with my condition? What would be the signs of having a relapse? How would I have support? So it has to be people who are doing really well and really motivated to get out. And if they didn't want to get out, if they felt safer in the institution, that would be a person that would stay there.
Yeah, and Tony, straight on right. I didn't realize that. I knew she's still behind bars in the mental institutes, but yeah, Andrea Yates consistently has chosen to stay review after review after review. Yeah.
So this could be a situation where, as with Lindsay Clancy, she tried to get into some help to another facility, and then they're like, "We don't qualify." Here, she could stay if she wanted to, because all she had to do was kill her kids first to finally get the help that she needs. I mean, it's horrible. I mean, it's insane. But this is how we work. Once you do something really horrible, then we'll take you seriously.
Yeah. Yeah.
What does it look like? Because I know everybody's thinking about all these possibilities. Here, run me down this scenario. Riddle me this. She's in the institution for a while. 5, 10 years, whatever. A period of time. She is released. She gets out into society. And everyone's fear, you know, that everyone's throwing out there online is, what if she has another baby? What if she bamboozles someone and they run off together and then she has... So let's just run through that. What if she does? What if she does go have a baby? What if she gets out and there's some relapsing or unhealthy behavior? Not necessarily criminal, not necessarily killing people, but just you're off your meds and we can tell you're not doing well. What sort of levers does the mental health apparatus have to go back and say, yeah, we got to bring you back here? Yeah, if anything, if no crimes have been committed.
Yeah, no, this is one of the things about monitoring folks outpatient if they were deemed safe to be outpatient. There's something called the terms and conditions of release. So it's conditional release. You're only released as long as you follow to the very strict rule, the terms and conditions. For people that have a drug history, they're tested weekly or randomly tested for drugs. And if they have let's say they test dirty for THC, immediately back. And we had the right as clinicians to make an immediate call to the police and say, immediately come pick this up and put them back in the hospital. And I would think a term and condition for her would be you don't get pregnant. Mm-hmm. And if you got pregnant, you would probably immediately go back in the hospital and the child would be placed somewhere. I think that would be, that would be watched very closely.
Is that indefinite? Like forever?
So
it's a case-by-case basis. You know, has somebody, let's say somebody committed a fairly minor crime, because some of the folks had committed minor crimes, but they did it when they were mentally ill. Like one guy was schizophrenic, and he decided one day to hijack the city bus around town, and he pulled out a butter knife and waved a butter knife around. That got him in the state hospital. He was eventually determined to have insight. He was on medication. You know, the crime had not hurt anybody. I mean, it was almost a rather silly kind of crime, but it was taken seriously. And he followed terms and conditions. But if there was anything at all that indicated he was not taking his meds, he was threatening anybody, he had paranoid thinking, anything like that, he would immediately go back in. So my guess is her terms and conditions would be very strict, and she would be monitored, possibly monitored for the rest of her life.
Here's an interesting stat on that, too. As we brought up the possibility of her getting out and giving birth again, remember, we have this little thing called menopause, and given her current age...
Not roughly, there yet.
well, she's got about... So if you're looking roughly, it's 15 years based on average age, and anywhere between 9 and 19 years. If she's in cars already beyond that, it wouldn't be an issue anyway.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of people's
I look up everything.
No, I mean, I get it. I mean, yeah, there's that, but she's not there yet. I mean, there's very real possibility that, you know, that could take place. Three defense experts diagnosed Lindsay with bipolar disorder, Tewksbury State Hospital, where she's been held for 3 years under one-to-one supervision, diagnosed her with bipolar. The prosecution's own expert, Kirk Helburn, took the stand and agreed. Bipolar type 2, the only person in the entire trial who disagreed was Avram Mack, who called it major depressive disorder. Helburn was supposed to be there to help the prosecution. Instead, he's confirmed the defense's diagnosis and handed them the argument that this was altruistic filicide, that she killed them out of love. That's the prosecution's own witness saying that, which to me sounds like a qualifying event to be found not guilty by reason of insanity.
It actually is.
She's currently on Zyprexa, which is an antipsychotic. I know all this because Siobhan corrected one of my questions when I sent it to her yesterday.
We've got such education on all this.
Yes. Great. So when the prosecution's own expert agrees with the defense on the diagnosis, what's the jury supposed to do with that?
Yeah. And we actually had more. We had, I made the list, right?
Yeah.
Dr. Donald Condi went over all the records going back from the beginning of her treatment. Serious possibility that has to be considered was bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
Paul Zeisel, bipolar disorder with postpartum psychosis. Now, this is an interesting one. Dr. Margaret Spinelli, who is considered one of the world's best forensic reproductive psychiatrists. And she evaluated her, but ultimately did not testify. And we do not know, we've not been told why she didn't testify. But her diagnosis, bipolar 1 disorder with postpartum psychosis, the jury will have access to that report. Philip Resnick, bipolar 2 disorder, severe depressive episode with postpartum psychosis at the time of the killing. Dr. Kirk Heilbrum for the prosecution, bipolar disorder, but rejected psychosis at the time of the killing. And then, of course, I think probably the worst witness was Dr. Mack, who went with major depressive disorder. But the other thing about that, you know, didn't come out at trial that I think is very relevant, you can have in severe major depressive disorder psychotic features. And that does not rule out that even if you went with just his diagnosis, which nobody else agreed with, she could have been psychotic from that.
So it all could happen under any of them. Yeah.
And the SI ideation from the massive depression and then the filicide, altruistic filicide, whether it's that as presented by one of the clinicians for the prosecution in there, or the other very similar diagnosis of the psychotic break all these terms, the psychotic break basically as the explanation as well. Both are qualifying for guilty by reason of insanity. So either or, and that's what they're all agreeing on, which is you made some great points, Javon.
Yeah.
So what's the issue?
Exactly. Like, why are we here? Why are we here? This just this could have been all handled. She said early on, you know, lock me away forever. And they were like, nope, we want to do this dog and pony show first. Let me ask you one quick question on this before we start talking more about all the Patrick stuff. Is there ever situations, and maybe this is a state-by-state thing, where someone, you know, is found guilty, goes to the prison system, and the prison system goes, this person needs a mental health hospital. They should not be in this. There's nothing we can do here that is going to keep, like, it's a liability to us. Not that they really care all that much, because people die all the times in prison. Mm-hmm. But do they make that call sometimes, going, this is a mental hospital person, not a prison?
Okay. Very much, that they can't be managed in prison. Because prisons do employ psychiatrists.
Yeah.
Now, they don't do the kind of treatment that you would get in a place like Tewksbury, but they do monitor folks. And yes, they can make a recommendation that we need to have a hearing and get this person over into a forensic mental health facility because they're, you know, they're, it's just not appropriate in prison. So that does happen. And the one thing that I wanted to just say a little bit about, because I think the general public is very confused. We heard a lot of references to the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And it's commonly referred to, which is completely inaccurate, as the Bible of mental health professionals. It is not the Bible. It's an evolving classification system based upon the best available evidence at the time and the clinical consistency at the time. But symptoms overlap. A lot of it is fuzzy. It is constantly changing. We get revisions every few years because teams and committees go in and take a section. They review, okay, what's the current literature? There's been new studies done. We look at it a bit differently now. And so it's changing. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, the DSM is published by the American Psychiatric Association. The rest of the world doesn't use it. Mm-hmm. They use, it's called the ICD. We're on the 11th version of that. And that's put out by the World Health Organization. And it organizes all diseases, including mental health conditions. And again, we're sort of like, we're still refusing to use the metric system here, right? We're just not.
We do better, right?
Yeah, and so a lot of people are saying the ICD-9, and so questions during the testimony came up about that, and I don't know that that was very well explained.
Yeah, that's what Reddington's been really hammering on that as well, I thought, every time he's been cross on.
He knows. He has been very educated on this stuff. I just want people to really know that the DSM is fuzzy. And if you get a room of six clinicians and they're looking at a complex case like this one, and they're trying to come up through the DSM, well, which category fits best? There's a lot of overlapping symptoms between the categories, and you may get six different opinions, and then everybody argues about it until they can come up with a consensus. So diagnosis is complicated, but it's so important that it be done well, because treatment plan is dependent on diagnosis. And we can see early on, when she was diagnosed with just generalized anxiety disorder, the treatment plan was inadequate. And it did not serve her, which is ultimately how we got into this mess.
And we're seeing in this, it's I think it's a segue for me to introduce this a little bit as well. You know, when my team was operating, the things we did was very similar to this. And that is, I had a specific function that I was doing for a case in operation. We need to assess a human being, what was going on in their lives, and how we were going to have a healthy interaction with them, whatever our objective was. What my team would do is we'd have people like me, which are the behavioral analysts and experts on human behavior at the practical field level, like interacting with human beings. We would come up with our observations, our points to consider, and the things that I've been talking about here with these life arcs. And then I'd have an operational psychologist with us. We'd have either Dr. Reed Malloy, we'd have Dr. Chris Mahandy, and as we just saw on the stand, Dr. Greg Satoff was also one of the people on my team. And each one of these clinicians had specific skill sets for specific things. And I knew what each one of these specific skill sets were. And I would hand pick the ones I need, not for confirmation bias, but because they had a specific skill set with a specific tool, technique, or human being they're interacting with. Like I've had multiple cases where I needed a hardcore clinician that could manage some people that are actually, we knew were kind of falling off the rails from the behavioral observation. So I brought in Dr. Reed Malloy. Mm-hmm. Hands down, a great guy for that. And then when it came to operational specifics, like we were doing some high tempo operations and people are going to be under a lot of stress, they've been through a lot of stress, I brought in my operational guy, which was Dr. Chris Mahandi. I mean, so I had these people. And then when I needed a psychiatrist with medical expertise, who had actually dealt with medications, things like that, I had Greg Satoff. So all these people fit a specific role that was very specific. And what we're seeing in this case, as presented by the prosecution, is it looks like they're throwing a shotgun at it. Let's try this. Mm-hmm. Let's try this. You know, and that's why we're seeing all over the board.
So why on earth did we end up with Greg Satoff on the stand? I mean, I guess that's my question, because he's an expert in certain areas without a doubt. I'm not trying to discredit or play him down at all, but it feels like, this is my conjecture, the prosecution has brought a lot of people as experts in certain areas, just not this one.
Yes.
And are trying to like present them as an expert in this area because they're experts over here. So it must kind of bleed over here a little bit, right? Is that because there's just not a lot of true experts on postpartum psychosis because 100%. It is so rare?
Yeah.
Tell me about that, Siobhan.
Yeah, 100%, because it is rare. Many people have never seen it. There's not, you know, copious amounts of data on it. And I was really struck by the prosecution expert witnesses who had seen it themselves, who mm-hmm. didn't understand it themselves. And I thought Reddington did a great job of pointing out their deficiencies in really understanding it.
Yeah, it became very predictable, like when we were texting back and forth when Dr. Greg Satoff took the stand. And I'll tell you, he has been a clinician a very long time.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen him in many years, and he was phenomenal on our team. Amazing, very well spoken, very well researched. But I was surprised to see him there in that kind of thing. So, because based on I didn't know his full background when working with him. I just knew it related to us. But I could predict what Reddington was going to do based on what I knew of that and exactly what's happening today, which has happened. It's not just him. It's all of them that actually don't have that expertise, which, as Siobhan just pointed out, it's a very, very rare and specific expertise. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. It is. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to break down the Lindsey Clancy trial. We got one more segment here to have a conversation about, and it's Patrick Clancy. He lost all three of his children on the same night. If you go on TikTok for a little while, you'd think he's a murderer running the streets in the dark wearing a mask. No, he lost all three of his children. He's a victim here, too. He found his wife at the base of their house after she jumped from a second-story window. These are just facts. He has since divorced. He has remarried. He moved to New York, and a significant portion of the internet has decided he's the one who should be on trial. It seems to start out, because I'm trying to wrap my mind around this. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author with us, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. As I try to wrap my mind around this, I'm trying to go from the beginning. Like, where do we get off the rails here? Where does Patrick become the villain in this case? Because I was very surprised when I first heard about this a couple weeks ago of people going down this road. And I think it kind of begins, at least for me, you tell me, Siobhan, of people trying to define what appropriate grief looks like, of which there is no such thing. There's no appropriate grief. But a lot of people seem to really think they know what it is, and they're not afraid to tell you that accepting a job in New York 4 months after your children died is very inappropriate because you might meet somebody there, and 3 years later you might get married, mm-hmm. to which he did. Oh my mm-hmm. God! Then he also went on a trip. He went on a like. When I read about the trip, people are like, oh, he went on a vacation. No, he didn't go on a cruise. He didn't go to sandals. It sounds very much like a soul-seeking I, quite honestly, when I read about where he went, I believe it was Costa Rica originally. Then he was staying in hostels in Europe because he didn't want to be around families because he couldn't stand the sight of it. Mm-hmm. So this to me sounds like a soul-finding trip, or you might find him out dead in a woods somewhere because he's decided he's had enough. It could have gone either way. That was inappropriate as well, because he left a review about a hike he went on. Oh my God, it was a hike that was peaceful for him after the living hell he's gone through. Somehow these are all horrible things. Where do you think this goes off the rail? Is it because people just are never satisfied with how someone grieves, so we must make them into a villain when it's not congruent to everyone else, or how one would handle such a horrific situation if it happened to them? God forbid.
God forbid. Yeah, this is, folks. And this has disappointed me in humanity, again, reading those things. I've just had to stay off Instagram because it's just flooded with it. As we've spoken, it's a lot of trying to turn him into a monster. Or the other group is trying to turn Lindsay into a monster. As we've said, there are no monsters here. And it's tragic because this is the kind of thing a therapist would suggest. Get away. Change your scene, because if you're staying, let's say he's staying in the home, staying in the town where this happened, he's going to be perseverating and never be able to get this out of his mind. I mean, I'm sure every day, most moments of the day, certainly at this point, this is in his mind. And clinically, these are all good things. Take a trip. Rediscover the meaning of life for you after this, you know, the life that you thought you had was shattered. And it's a therapeutic thing to do. It's a healthy thing to do. And certainly finding a person who is healthy, who is comforting to you, who has compassion for you, that's also good therapy. So I find this urge to punish him, it's sadistic, and it really disappoints me in people.
That I'm so glad to hear you say that's what a therapist would recommend, because I thought about this yesterday. It's not just him witnessing and seeing and being part of the loss of his three children and, to a large extent, the loss of his wife. I can't imagine, and help me understand how he can even deal with survivor's guilt on this one.
Yeah. Because I'm amazed he's alive, quite honestly.
I mean, seriously, so, because no one's even talking about what he must be going through, not just on witnessing what he saw when he walked in there and lost his shit, as we have heard through people in the 911 call.
People are going on him for that, too, because he said the F word in front of the kids. But, oh, no.
But can you imagine the survivor's guilt of him saying to himself, what could I have done? What should I have done? I shouldn't have done this. All the what ifs going through the mind of what he lost and blaming himself for that. Yeah. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to even think Tony was saying, how he's still alive.
Here's the ignorance.
How's the therapist, how do you deal with that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, literally. Okay, Siobhan, tell me. You have a patient that's coming to you to see you for regular sessions, and they say this: Patrick may not have been directly involved, but he basically abandoned his family. He never helped Clancy with the kids and conveniently went on trips. This is the line of shit I keep seeing from everywhere.
That's why he's got
survivors which, by the way, can all be debunked pretty quick if you take 2 seconds to just educate yourself rather than just spew the venom that you're hearing online. Juvenile 69. Lindsay struggled alone for a long time. This is like the facts that they believe they have, when reality is completely different. He was there helping her. Did he go on a business trip? Yes. Holy shit, he did. There was also two mothers that were there helping with her and the kids. He was not out gallivanting around the city.
Both said he's a great guy.
Like, what the fuck? I mean, I'm just, people grab onto this shit and then they put a narrative of who he is and they believe it. So again, you're sitting there, it's time for the appointment. I come in and I tell you, and I'm enraged. Oh my God, did you hear this, Siobhan? Mm. And I spew off that bullshit to you. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to me as the patient coming in going, ha!
Yeah, where I would go, speaking as a therapist with someone like that, and as a therapist, you can't beat people over the head with, you know, the alternate point of view. You have to question them.
Yeah.
And tell me the story of your life that that makes you think that this is true.
Yeah, the answers come.
Yeah. What man has treated you badly? Let's do your own relationship history here.
Yep.
Because clearly you're angry, and that anger is coming from somewhere within you. So let's go there. Let's go a little deeper, and then let's say we got some material and we spent some time talking about all the ways that this person had been wronged by men and how come they have so much. Because a lot of it is just anger at men, you know.
It's
men
unresolved, right? I mean,
it's unresolved stuff.
Yeah. Is that why we see? Let's discover your life arc.
Yeah, I mean, is that why, exactly? I mean, is that why we're seeing so much of this, and why it doesn't? And there's nothing that can really penetrate it. There's nothing, like, facts don't seem to matter when you're like, no, that's completely inaccurate.
Yeah.
Because the inside, it's not even about Lindsay Clancy. It's not about Patrick Clancy. It's about oneself if they're going down this road. And if it's unresolved, it's still going to be unresolved. And is it just like a roadblock and they're incapable of seeing things a different way because they're too caught up in their own shit? Like in a way that's just non-penetrable? I mean, I'm trying to wrap my mind around some of it.
Yeah. No, I think you nailed it. It can be impenetrable, and people are telling themselves stories to make sense of things, but the stories are coming from their own motivated reasoning, because that's how they're getting through life, is by telling these stories. And often they have a victim story about how they were victimized. They haven't resolved that. They're still enraged. And then they see this and they project that, you know, Patrick is a monster, which, as you say, the facts do not support this in any way. No, nobody has indicated that, right? All the people we've talked to or we've heard testimony from, nobody has indicated that Patrick was a cruel husband, a neglectful husband. And I go back to this point, which I have seen time and time again. Families are not trained to recognize severe mental illness. They may know something's wrong. They may have empathy. They encourage the person, well, go to therapy and get help, but the therapist never invites them in to say, what are you seeing? So that's where you get the failure on the therapist side.
Yeah.
But there's just a lack of insight and a lot of projection going on. And so that's where I would start, is let's talk about where your anger is really coming from.
Yeah. And then think about this. Again, I know people like this are rejecting the facts and data and details. If there was any inkling that they thought Patrick was less than the husband he needed to be, who do you think, under testimony, would have been the first people to throw him under the bus? Lindsay's parents.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very they much. Didn't.
Yes.
Plus everyone else. Because it would have been a scapegoat to help her get off.
Very
And
much.
They didn't. And that says, to me, again, when you look at that circle of people around you, it just says it all to me.
I agree. Bitter Black 3014 said he seemed way more supportive than most, actually. That was my reaction, too.
That was my reaction,
too. I'm like, she seems like a pretty grounded dude.
Yeah.
Like I've seen far worse husbands. Like,
oh, he doesn't. Yeah.
He's not even, like, on a bad scale. It's like, he's on the good scale over here. Like, he's limited because he's, like anyone would be, because he's not a mental health professional.
Right.
That's most people.
Right.
So he's doing the best with what information he has. Yeah. And it seemed he put up with a lot of shit and dealt with a lot of stuff for those years of postpartum depression that she was going through, and undiagnosed bipolar.
Yes.
I'm honestly kind of surprised he didn't get divorced years earlier out of the stress of this marriage that might have been going on there. But the fact that he's there, he's forgiven her, he's still standing by her side. I mean, he could be the biggest devil in the world to her if he wanted to be. He could be on the stand saying, let her burn, and not basing any of his opinions on mental health awareness or facts or understanding. He could just be, screw it, I don't accept any of it. You killed the kids, burn her, and let me encourage you all to send her to the fiery pits. Yeah. But he's not. He's saying, please have grace. If he's the one who did this and doesn't want to be caught, don't you think he'd be up there on the stand encouraging her to go off to the eternal flames?
That's just logic. That's just logic, isn't it? And one of the things that I see people keep coming up, you know, at some point when I believe it was Rebecca Gelada raised the possibility of bipolar disorder. So there's another one that said bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
And he said, my wife's not bipolar. That is classic for families. I have had to go through that with families many times. When you say, I'm afraid your teenage son is developing schizophrenia. Oh, that can't be. That can't be. That can't be. When I had my one severe case of crisis postpartum psychosis that I had in my office, and the first thing I did was call in the husband from work, call in her parents, call in her sister, and sat with all of them and said, I am seeing something really serious here. It looks like psychosis. Everyone in the room said, oh, no, no, no. She's just anxious. She's always been anxious. It can't be something like that. And people respond strongly to hearing that their loved one has a major mental illness, and they don't want to believe that.
Yeah.
So again, that isn't him trying to sabotage her or not listening. That's a typical response from families.
Yes, that's the normal response you're going to get.
Yes.
It's not like, it's bipolar? Yes! Like, nobody's going to do that.
No.
And I'll tell you, you know my first impression when I started seeing his testimony of what he was doing as a husband? I'm going to project and be with my own transparency. I was like, holy crap, I need to be a better husband. And everyone would tell you, I was like, wow, I don't, like when my wife has her medical appointments, do I know that level of detail? Because of what he was doing and doing the best he could, I was like, I need to be better. I mean, so I totally saw it in a different light. It's like, wow, he kind of set this example for a lot of the husbands saying, I think I need to be a little bit more knowledgeable and involved with my wife's medical and physical health.
100%.
Because my wife doesn't have mental health at all, but I'm like, I don't know all the ins and outs, maybe she doesn't want me to, of all the appointments she goes to, but I feel like I need to a little bit more because, damn, this guy, look at all he did, and he still missed it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I would say this to anybody who's out there going, didn't he do this? Didn't he do that? If you're going, didn't he? You don't know. So you stop repeating it as a fact. Mm-hmm. And how about you do a little thing? You can Google. You can chat GPT. You can look all of these things up. You don't have to like rely on the internet to just feed you the answer to the mystery that surrounds your brain when you are in a world where you can have your questions answered like that. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. But nobody does it. We'd rather repeat insanity, rinse and do it all over again. Makes us feel better about ourselves. Mm-hmm. One more thing. Rusty Yates lost 5 children when Andrea Yates drowned them during a psychotic episode in 2001. He's one of the only people alive who knows what Patrick is going through. His advice after 25 years, find supportive people and stop trying to please everyone. Yeah. What would you say to Patrick? Siobhan, and we'll wrap on that.
It's a tough one. It's a tough one. My heart goes out to him. My heart goes out to his family. I can't wait for this to die down. And I'm sure he feels that even more intensely. But yes, find help, find support, probably therapy with someone who's really good with trauma and understands all this stuff. And surround yourself with people who love you and find comfort and joy. And there's just a lot of work to be done, as you said, about the survivor's guilt. And I will say every family member who has someone who unalives themselves deals with survivor's guilt. What should I have done? How could I have stopped this? How could I have made a difference? And that's just part of it. But he really needs help and support with that. And, you know, this has changed him. He'll not be the same person he was, but this doesn't mean he can't integrate this and go on and rebuild a good life. And that's the hope I have for him.
Unless the TikTokers have something to say about it.
Yeah.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. The links are there in the description. We'd love for you to weigh in. Siobhan's books, they're right here. Nightbird, this is her memoir. Highly suggest getting it, checking it out. You can get it on Amazon, audiobook on Audible. Also, The Minds of Mass Killers available. Go check those out. Robin's latest, It's Not All About Me. It's available also on Amazon, wherever you get pod or wherever you get audiobooks as well. And what?
I can add one more thing.
We can officially add?
We can say it. So yeah, out tomorrow, folks. My masterclass. I have a class on masterclass. Become the person everyone trusts based on everything we do here. How to critically think through relationships and everything in life. So we'll put the links and everything in there. But out tomorrow is thanks. So I'm a masterclass instructor now. So my thanks to everyone.
You're not even having to do the fake TikToks that people make. You're actually hosting a masterclass.
I am. They send me, and I'll post around the promo reel and everything for it. They did an amazing job. I couldn't be more humbled by them. The team at Masterclass is absolutely phenomenal. It's a great opportunity to celebrate them and their skill set as much as they've been kind enough to celebrate mine. So thank you, everyone.
Well, there you go. I can't wait to check that out on Masterclass. We'll put the links in the descriptions as well. Send those links over to Todd and Lisa, by the way, so we can get those into the descriptions. All right, that'll wrap it up. Until next time, for Robin, for Siobhan, and Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.